this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "It's time for the pantry to untangle itself or else. The pantry is attempting to reverse a course of declining profitability and changing market conditions. Will the Kerry Company succeed?" And that's the headline on the front page. And then there's a second headline inside where the cover story actually begins. And that headline, "Refueling and Retooling the Pantry. Kerry-based convenience store company must adapt to changes in industry, consumer habits." This article is written by Jesse Burkhardt. In a region best known for its flourishing technology, healthcare, and pharmaceutical industries, the pantry is one of the Triangle's largest and oldest companies, albeit in a sector that traditionally has been less than glamorous. That sector, convenience stores, has been forced to adapt as two historically reliable revenue streams, gasoline and tobacco, have slowed due to the advent of fuel-efficient vehicles and a decline in the number of smokers. Other chains, such as Sheetz and Circle K, have responded by establishing virtual roadside meccas with quick-service restaurants, QSRs, as magnets to lure customers. However, the pantry, which primarily operates under the Kangaroo Express brand, has been slower to adapt to the changing industry. Now, the company finds itself in catch-up mode, and with 14,431 employees spread across the Southeast, including 3,519 in North Carolina, the stakes are high for the company, which dates its lineage to 1967 in Sanford. After the pantry went public in 1999, it blossomed over the next decade into a dominant convenience store player with 1,500-plus locations spanning 13 states. But over the past 2 years, the company's bottom line has bled red as its store base has dwindled. The company's recent performance has prompted the question as to whether one of the Triangle's only multi-billion-dollar corporations is strong enough to make a counterattack and rebound. Or might the pantry become bait for private equity players who are prowling to buy companies on the cheap? Dennis Hatchell, the pantry's fourth chief executive since 2009, is the man responsible for executing a turnaround, primarily by developing alternative revenue streams and decreasing reliance on legacy product categories. Wanted: new revenue sources. Hatchell collected more than 39 years of experience in the grocery business before he was named the pantry's CEO in March of 2012. After spending the previous 16 years as the president of Alex Lee Incorporated, the parent company of Winston-Salem-based Lowe's Foods, Hatchell's resume caught the attention of the pantry's board of directors, which was preparing to embark on its new strategy of increasing the number of stores with quick-service restaurants. Currently, QSRs account for 11% of the pantry's $1.8 billion in merchandising sales, while the national average for convenience stores is 17%. It's clear to the company's brass that they have some catching up to do. "Our goal is to close this gap over the next several years, and by doing so will help to offset the declines we are seeing in cigarettes," says Hatchell, who plans to add QSRs to 70 stores over the next two fiscal years. The reality, though, is that the pantry is now more than 2 years into its new game plan, yet it remains one of the few public companies in its sector tracking negative returns in recent years. Over the last 5 years, investors have punished the company by taking down its stock price by 12%, and the pantry's market capitalization has shrunk accordingly. The company just recorded its fourth consecutive year of declining EBITDA, earnings before everything, with $202.4 million in 2013, a 14.8% slump from the $237.6 million it recorded in 2010. And although the company recorded $7.8 billion in revenue last year, one of its best performances over the past decade, it still lost money. Coupled with the elimination of 135 stores and leveraging the company to the tune of $900 billion in debt, Hatchell's game plan should be clear: increase profitability across all lines of business. Some analysts are less than certain if Hatchell will be able to pull this off in the short run. The most recent report from Australian investment banking firm Macquarie Group projects a 6% decline in EBITDA and an 11.4% decline in the pantry's revenue over the next 3 years, noting that continued declines in market share and volatility, with the senior management team cloud the view of what the company is truly worth. Internal strife. The underwhelming financial performance can be traced in large part to instability at the top of the company's food chain. The pantry's board of directors is hoping that Hatchell is a long-term solution after having cycled through three CEOs since 2009. The executive shuffle isn't confined to the C-suite either, as the inner turmoil has now spilled over into other levels of its operation. Most recently, John Venezia left his post as Senior Vice President of Operations in February, the latest in a string of executive departures dating back to Hatchell's appointment. Unhappy with its return on investment, a group of disgruntled shareholders, JCP Investment Management and Lone Star Value Management, which together own about 2% of the company, recently nominated three hand-picked candidates to the board. After engaging the company in a months-long proxy fight, all three nominees won election to the board at the annual shareholders meeting in March. Among the candidates to win a seat on the board is James Pappas, the CEO of JCP, who has spoken critically of the company's operational decision-making. He specifically points to $1.8 billion that has been spent on acquisitions and capital improvements over the past 10 years, saying there has been no material improvement in earnings to show for it. I think it comes down to making sure you have the right people in place and not spending money on things that won't give you a return, Papa said before his election. You can see from the total returns of the company over the past 10 years, there's a tremendous amount to do. Near the top of Pappas's checklist is raising the company's operating performance up to the level of its most similar publicly traded competitors. Alimentation Couch Tard Incorporated, Casey's General Stores Incorporated, and Susser Holdings Corporation, which are delivering vastly greater shareholder returns. Diane Leone, who follows the pantry for Macquarie, indicated in her latest report that the low valuation could attract suitors. We do think the company is inexpensive relative to its breakup value, Leone says. This valuation would place a sale of the company at one of the lowest valuations for comparative transactions over the past 15 years. The price of profitability. Board member Pappas believes the path back to profitability begins with bolstering the company's food service business, an initiative already underway, and trimming underperforming assets from the balance sheet. In materials presented to shareholders before the board election, JCP and Lone Star estimated that 300 to 500 stores are poor performers and proposed that they be sold for cash that could be reinvested in better performing stores. But if the pantry starts down the slippery slope of shuttering stores, payrolls would be slashed in the process. Yet, it's an idea the board is likely to entertain now that one-third of its membership has indicated support for such a restructuring. Faced with no other choice, Hatchell says he is prepared to work cooperatively with the new board members. That's now part of a balancing act in which he will forge ahead with the strategy he has been implementing for the past 2 years, for better or for worse. There are strong competitors that operate within our markets that we are aware of and monitor closely, he says. Our goal is to understand by store location where competition is having a significant impact and to react accordingly. And there's a shorter story that accompanies the cover story. The headline, Humble Beginnings from the Sandhills Duo. Before the pantry became a dominant convenience store player with a footprint stretching across 13 states, the company began as a partnership between two men with one store. Founded in Sanford in 1967, the pantry was started by Sam Warnam and Truby Proctor Jr., each of whom had complementary knowledge of the industry they were entering. Warnam understood the inner workings of running a retail business, while Proctor handled gasoline and real estate selection. Together, they embarked upon an aggressive growth strategy that relied equally upon acquisitions and building new stores. What we did was buy other chains, Warnam says. We bought one chain in South Carolina that had a little over 100 stores, and another chain up in Kentucky, Tennessee area that had a little less than 100 stores. We bought smaller chains all over. We had several acquisitions that helped us to grow, and we built a number of stores too. There were 450 locations by 1987, which is when Warnam and Procter sold their controlling stake in the company to investment firm Montrose Capital. Peter Sodini was subsequently installed as the CEO, and he nearly quadrupled the company's store count to more than 1,600 while helping take the company public in 1999 as part of his 13-year tenure. Thanks to the pioneering vision of its founders and an acquisition strategy created by a shrewd chief executive, the pantry had quickly become the largest convenience store chain in the Southeast. And along with this cover story article, there's also a list of their past CEOs titled The CEO Shuffle. First, there's Peter Sodini, appointed 1996, departed 2009. Among Sodini's most notable accomplishments during his 13-year tenure as CEO was helping take the pantry public in 1999. Terry Marks, appointed 2009, departed 2011. A former minor league pitcher, Marks spent 20 years at Coca-Cola before he was tapped as Sodini's successor. He resigned just 2 years later to become the CEO of Hooters. Edwin Holman, appointed 2011, departed 2012. Following Marks' resignation, Holman was named CEO on an interim basis. He served on the pantry's board of directors for 9 years before being ousted in a proxy vote in March. And Dennis Hatchell, appointed 2012. Hatchell came to the pantry after spending 39 years in the grocery business. And now we turn to the biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. And in this edition, there's a large picture of Tiger Woods under the headline, "No Tiger Hunting at Pinehurst in June." With the announcement that Tiger Woods will be missing the Masters Golf Tournament this year, folks at Pinehurst, hosting the 2014 U.S. Open Championships in June, did not have to wait long to find out if Woods will be making the trip to North Carolina. He won't. As Biz and others are keenly aware that Woods' absence from any tournament generally impacts attendance and television viewing, a quick call to Reg Jones, the man in charge of this year's U.S. Open, seemed appropriate. While we would certainly miss Tiger as a three-time U.S. Open champion, it should not have an appreciable effect on attendance, Jones notes. The fact that the Open is our national championship and only in Pinehurst every 8 to 12 years, I think that makes the impact different than perhaps on a yearly tour event. Biz agrees with Jones in terms of attendance on the course, but there is little doubt that the absence of Woods will have an impact on television audience numbers during the 4 days of the men's tourney starting June 12. Well, that's one less distraction for Phil Mickelson, Rory McIlroy, Adam Scott, and a host of other players. CASL honors 40th with gift to Yao Fund. The Capital Area Soccer League, CASL, CASL, celebrated the club's 40th birthday at WRAL Soccer Center on March 15. The celebration included a $10,000 donation to the K. Yao Cancer Fund. The club is one of the biggest in the nation, with a budget of $7 million, and will see roughly 9,000 soccer players come through its system of 550 teams. It received national recognition by being named a top 10 club by Soccer America in 2012, and most recently, a top 10 elite clubs National League, ECNL, club in 2013. Durham Distillery takes home medal. The Brothersville Galus Spirits Company recently won a silver medal at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition out of 1,400 brands competing. There was no actual presentation of it, just a competition we send samples to, which we sent samples to, which were tasted by a panel of judges, says co-owner Rim Vigalis. While there's a number of similar competitions around the world, this is the big spirits competition. Cirque Show was a real thriller night. As a self-proclaimed music connoisseur, Biz made sure to catch Cirque du Soleil's tribute to the King of Pop in Michael Jackson the Immortal at PNC Arena on April 1. The performers entertained the crowd with 2 hours of MJ's classics, including Human Nature, Thriller, Beat It, and a mega mix that got the entire audience on their feet dancing. Biz was especially impressed with Gene B-Boy Horth Sok, one of the troupe's performers, who was strutting his stuff with only one leg. And along with that, there's a MJ by the numbers, 10. That's how many hours it takes the crew to unload and assemble the stage for Michael Jackson, the Immortal, before each performance. 100, the number of extras hired to help the crew set up the stage for the live performance. 130, the number of people that tour with Michael Jackson, the Immortal. That includes 38 performers, 11 musicians, and 52 crew members. 250, the number of costumes used in Cirque du Soleil's performance of Michael Jackson, the Immortal. 1,500, the total number of props and pieces of costumes used during the performance. 30, the number of trucks it takes to transport all the set designs, costumes, and equipment. And 35, the number of Michael Jackson songs performed in the two-hour set. This includes several mashups and one mega mix. And for the tweets of the week, still have the tingles that are only felt on opening day. I feel like I'm 8 years old again. So fortunate to call my childhood passion my life. And that's from Patrick Keenas, announcer for the Durham Bulls. Voted for stakeholders group to look at inside the window signage, hold several public meetings to gather and report other concerns. That's from Marianne Baldwin, Raleigh City Council member. Ann and I are lighting the Executive Mansion in blue again, this time for World Autism Awareness Day. And that's from Governor Patrick McCrory. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we come to the page of Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The first headline, two ITB infill projects in the works. KB Homes and MI Homes, two prolific home builders in the Triangle, who traditionally have focused on more suburban neighborhoods, are switching course and breaking ground on two new infill communities located inside the Beltline. MI Homes is building 83 townhouse units at its Grove at Fallon Park community near the Five Points area of Raleigh, on land that was formerly a Wake County Public Schools Central Services site. KB Home is building 39 single-family homes at its new Oakwood North neighborhood near downtown Raleigh and the historic Oakwood neighborhood, and it expects to open the model home in late April. New homes in both communities will be priced in the mid-$300,000. Tom Sawitsky, Raleigh Division President for KB Home, says finding a 10.8-acre site in downtown Raleigh, so close to Oakwood, was a unique opportunity for the company. We absolutely jumped at it, he says. So far, KB has added 60 people to the interest list for sites at Oakwood North, which is much higher than the early interest list KB would have for similarly sized community in another part of the Triangle. And all the advertising we've done so far is a simple sign on the property, Sawitsky says. In the state purchasing section, the headline is, e-sourcing will save state $5 million per year. North Carolina state government offices are streamlining the way they buy paper and office supplies, starting with two multi-million-dollar contracts recently awarded to just two vendors. Mac Papers, a Florida-based distributor of paper products with offices across North Carolina, was recently awarded the loan contract to supply paper products to North Carolina government offices. Charlotte-based Forms and Supply Incorporated was awarded the loan contract to supply most other office supply products. The actual value of those contracts is contingent upon how much the state orders from the companies over the three-year term of their agreements. But North Carolina Department of Administration's Chief Operating Officer, D. Jones, estimates the new contracts will save the state about $5 million per year. State Purchasing Officer Patty Bowers says local groups participating in the e-procurement process can also take advantage of discounted rates of these vendors. And finally, we have two retail notes. on Reporter Hoyle's page. The first one is headlined, Chubby's Tacos Gets New Name, New Look. The owner of the popular Chubby's Tacos restaurant chain in the Triangle will be rolling out his restaurant's new brand and new name in late April, and this time he's filed for federal trademark registration. The new name will be Guacamaya, according to a filing with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, a Spanish word for macaw. Owner Jody Lighton had launched a campaign in December to identify a new moniker after he found out that a Colorado restaurant group had already trademarked the El Chubby's name, which would limit his expansion opportunities beyond North Carolina's borders. Fresh Market is going underground. Greensboro-based The Fresh Market is making plans to expand its Cameron Village store location in Raleigh. It plans to move all of its prepared food operations to a basement space, which would open up more shopping space on the main level. And now we turn to Jason DeBrun's page. He covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The first headline, Why Liposcience Fired a Profitable Customer? Raleigh diagnostics company Liposcience Incorporated terminated its relationship with Health Diagnostics Laboratory Incorporated, one of its laboratory customers, after HDL began offering its own version of roughly the same test Liposcience manufactures. Liposcience generates nearly all of its revenue through blood tests, which are read by what are called clinical analyzers, and has sold more than 11 million tests. On March 17, HDL, based in Richmond, Virginia, began offering its own non-FDA cleared test for the measurement of low-density lipoprotein particles, similar to the kind of diagnostic test Liposcience offers, though Howard Doran, Liposcience's president and CEO, touts that his company's tests received clearance from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, while others have not. The move will hurt Liposcience's top line, and the company already revised quarterly revenue projections down to $11.8 million from $12.2 million. We will take actions that are necessary to protect the interests of patients and physicians, as well as Liposcience's business. Our contract with HDL Incorporated has accounted for a significant portion of our total revenues over the past few years, and the discontinuation of our contract is unfortunate. However, we see this as an opportunity to expand our business with existing lab partners and continue to focus on the appropriate utilization of our tests for physicians to manage patients with cardiovascular disease. Doran, who was named CEO in January, said. And in the Biopharma Snippets section, Biogen's approval means local work. Biogen IDEC received approval to market its hemophilia B treatment, Alprolix, in the United States. It will make the product in its facilities in the Triangle. Biogen IDEC did not release sales projections, though it has estimated the current market for hemophilia B products at about $1 billion per year. Thomson Reuters data estimates Alprolix will generate sales of $286 million by 2019. Hemophilia B, which reduces the ability for blood clotting, occurs in about 1 in 25,000 male births annually, and more rarely in females, affecting about 4,000 people in the United States. The World Federation of Hemophilia Global Survey, conducted in 2012, estimates that approximately 28,000 people are currently diagnosed with hemophilia B worldwide. People with hemophilia B experience bleeding episodes that cause pain, irreversible joint damage, and life-threatening hemorrhages. GSK recalls drug after tampering fears. GlaxoSmithKline Consumer Healthcare recalled all Ally weight loss products from U.S. and Puerto Rico retailers, saying it believes some of the packages were tampered with. GSK says it will conduct an investigation and is working with the knowledge of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on this retailer-level recall. GSK, based in London, has its North American headquarters in Research Triangle Park. Now we turn to the page of reporter Dawn Curry, who covers small business personalities and Triangle trends. The first headline, Jewel Maker in Need of a Branding Boost. Morrisville-based Charles & Colvard, which makes diamond-like jewels called moissanite from silicon carbide acquired from Cree, is not getting any love from Wall Street, although the company's executives reported 27% annual growth in net sales. During a recent earnings call, analysts questioned the firm's low cash flow, large inventory, and a lack of bricks-and-mortar retail. Charles & Colvard's net sales increased 27% in 2013 to finish at $28.5 million. Net sales were the highest levels since 2006, says Chief Financial Officer Kyle Macemore. For the full year of 2013, net sales of loose jewels increased approximately 23% to $18.5 million compared to $15 million in 2012. But several analysts during the earnings call pointed out that in 2012, the Charles & Colvard balance sheet listed $11.8 million in cash and cash equivalents, which in 2013 drops to $2.5 million. Meanwhile, year-end inventory grew to $13 million from 2012's $8 million. I have noticed that the inventory creeps up, creeps up, creeps up, and then it again pulls it up with the quarter, pulls it up with quarter. And of course, that causes a drain on your cash, and cash is down low, said Gerard Levin, an analyst with Morgan Stanley. Macemore countered that Charles & Colvard bought inventory from Cree in 2013, but believes the cash on hand will allow the company to proceed to run the business. However, the company seems to have bought the large inventory in the hopes that it will supply e-commerce avenues such as Kohl's online store and the company's failed Amazon.com effort. If they can reboot it, they may not be having the best of luck in bricks and mortar stores. Mark Robbins of Catalyst Research mentioned moissanite lacking branding, to which CEO Steve Larkin responded that retailers who have spent decades in the diamond business are scared of moissanite. They are afraid that it will cannibalize sales from their diamonds, and they have already made the investment in their diamonds. Meanwhile, the company's stock is sinking. It started March 24 at about $4.26 per share and closed April 1 trading at $2.80 per share. Pinehurst rooms still available. There are still hotel rooms available in Pinehurst for those planning to attend the U.S. Open Championships in mid-June. The Convention and Visitors Bureau for Moore County said that all hotel and motel rooms were booked for the event. But according to Jordan Walters, sales manager at the Pinehurst Southern Pines Holiday Inn Express, the hotel didn't respond to the Visitors Bureau's most recent inquiry. I have spots available, says Walters. We had a minimum of 5 nights, and we are lifting the 5-day minimum. Currently, 85% of the hotel is booked for the event, and the remaining rooms are going for $450 per night. We didn't give our hotel rooms to the Visitors Bureau because they fill the rooms mainly with USGA, and we're doing it for the spectators, says Walters. We want to get all the golf gurus here. June 11, the night before the first U.S. Open event, is on a Wednesday. For perspective, on a Wednesday in September, regular rates for the hotel are $87 for a room with one king-size bed. Christmas Eve rates are also $87 per night for the same room. The stink bugs are coming. The stink bugs are coming. Spring is here, and you'll likely see bugs in and around your home and office. Spare the hassle of calling out the exterminator for ladybugs and tweet or email your bug pictures to the North Carolina Pest Management Association's Pest Line, only available during April. That's at pestline@ncpestmanagement.org. And now we turn to the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. She covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her main article is headlined, Young, Area Needs Higher Startup Count. And there's a large picture of co-founder Bob Young, who helped bring Red Hat to Raleigh in 1995, according to the caption. Bob Young is an unassuming man in a baseball cap with a quiet, self-deprecating sense of humor. I am to technical people what a groupie is to a rock band, he laughs. In other words, what's the point of being in a rock band if you don't have people to appreciate the music? Behind that baseball cap is the mind of the man responsible for Red Hat, the open source behemoth that he brought to Raleigh in 1995 with co-founder Mark Ewing. Young, who thinks of himself not as an engineer but as a salesperson, is Canadian by birth and North Carolinian by choice. And Red Hat's not the end of his story. In addition to supporting his wife's needlepoint.com business, he also heads growing self-publishing firm Lulu and is a vocal board member of Raleigh drone startup Precision Hawk. And he's great at answering questions. Several companies, Iprio and EvaluServe among them, mention Red Hat as one of their inspirations for moving to downtown Raleigh. How does that feel? We all stand on the shoulders of giants, so Red Hat in turn ended up in North Carolina largely because Jim Goodnight was able to build SAS Institute in North Carolina. So we knew it was possible to build a global technology company in the Triangle. We had pioneers. We could point at SAS and say, no, it's quite possible to do this in North Carolina. So when Mark Ewing and I had the opportunity, we made the conscious decision. We could have built in Connecticut. We could have packed up our development team and moved to Silicon Valley. We chose to do it in North Carolina. You think of it as paying it forward. There's a lot of talk about Raleigh being an entrepreneurship capital. Do you think it can happen? Yes, collectively, individually. Individually, it's scary. 4 out of 5 startups won't work, so it's a high-risk thing to do. But you have 100 startups, and even though you know 4 or 5 of those are going to be yesterday's news, 1 out of 5 in 100 is 20 companies launched in a year. But the challenge isn't to get 100, it's to get 500 or 1,000 new companies. It's an ongoing battle, and the state government has to do a good job to create an environment to attract the biggest and brightest to North Carolina. Why didn't you retire to your beach house after Red Hat? At the end of the day, beach houses are lovely things, but I'm like everyone else on the planet. When I get out of bed in the morning, we want to make the world a better place. And the problem with going to our beach house is, other than making our immediate family's world a better place, my wife loves going to the beach house, I don't actually get to make the world a better place in quite as impactful a way. Lulu just allows me to make a contribution, making the world a better place faster than playing golf does. If you saw my golf game, you'd realize how true that statement is. This is so much more fun than hanging out at the beach. You say you're not a tech guy. What advice would you have for your entrepreneurial counterparts, people who aren't necessarily technical but dream of starting a company? You have to build a team, and in the modern world, you can build a team by hiring people, but also by partnering with firms. Whether they're in the Triangle, whether they're in India, whether they're in China, the world is getting to be a very small place, and that's the challenge North Carolina has too. Speaking of attracting the biggest and brightest, what do you think about the plans for Research Triangle Park? Bob Giolis, CEO of Research Triangle Foundation, is spearheading a campaign to bring residential, retail, and restaurant features to the industrial park. I'm thrilled. That was always the problem when I worked in the park. There was nowhere interesting to go to lunch. What's your favorite movie? Back when I was a kid, I would drag every girl I was dating to my favorite movie as a test. I don't think I met a girl who likes this movie, including my wife, Lawrence of Arabia. The photography in it is just spectacular. Will you ever retire? My wife won't let me. She says she'll kill me if I retire. Among other things, I'm convinced that had I been brought up in today's world, I would have been diagnosed with ADD. And had I been, I might have gotten a prescription for Ritalin, and I might have gone to a good school and made something of myself. I'm not a fan of Ritalin, for the record, and I'm not a fan of an ADD diagnosis, and no, I cannot imagine retiring. New apartment community opens at edge of RTP. The Research Triangle Park area's newest luxury apartment complex is ready for tenants. Jacksonville, Florida-based LandSouth Construction announced it has completed a $19.8 million community in Durham called Phillips at Research Park. We first told you about the complex in 2012. That's when Florida real estate firm Phillips Development and Realty secured $26.7 million in construction loan financing to build the 292-unit apartment complex. With units ranging from 780 to 1,173 square feet of living space. Phillips offers 20 acres of woodlands for walking, jogging, or biking, and on-site bocce courts, as well as the typical amenities such as a fitness center and a pool. The complex is located across from the northern entrance of GlaxoSmithKline's main campus in RTP. Units were supposed to open last spring with the project complete by September of 2013, but a spokesperson tells us move-in was delayed to last July. The units are 64% occupied, with 73% pre-leased as of Tuesday afternoon. Rent starts at $860 per month for the one-bedroom, the Blue Devil floor plan, $1,010 for the two-bedroom, the Wolfpack plan, and $1,115 for the three-bedroom, the Tar Heel plan, according to the apartment website. And in an In His Own Words section, the headline, What Did You Learn From Your Mentor? And this is the quote from Scott Wingo, CEO of Channel Advisor. I've had several mentors, he says. The person that got me into entrepreneurship would be my dad. He was kind of a nerdy entrepreneur before it was cool to be one. We lived in the little town of Aiken, South Carolina. He started out doing consulting. I kind of grew up with that as the dinner conversation. Other mentors include Richard Holcomb, the serial entrepreneur behind Strike Iron, HAHT Commerce, and Q&E Software. Wingo says he looks for mentors, people whose experience can help guide the company as board members. And finally on this page, there's a They Said It section that first starts with Lisa Grimes, president and CEO of Morrisville antimicrobial fabric startup Pure Thread Technologies. Her quote is, we hopefully will have a deal to announce in the next 2 weeks. And she offers a big hint. Athletic wear, Grimes told me last year the firm was very close to signing a deal with a firm she described as a brand new sportswear company. The next quote, it's a great opportunity for us to really capitalize on the fact that we have companies like Wedpix in the social space here in Raleigh. And that's from Justin Miller, CEO of Raleigh-based social wedding app Wedpix, speaking to us after closing a $1.5 million financing round, a round he says benefits the entire Triangle entrepreneurship effort. The next quote, we think we have a really good recipe for what I would call an emerging tech market. We think we know the roles people play and the things that have to be there. That's from Chris Heavely, co-founder of Durham's The Startup Factory, on plans to expand the accelerator to other cities. And finally, the first 4 years of Tier Science, we didn't even have a website. You don't need that. Focused on what you are creating. And that's from Tim Willis, co-founder and CEO of Morrisville medical device firm Tier Science, elaborating on his belief that entrepreneurs need to maintain their focus. And in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal's Executive Voice, we speak with Jim Whitehurst. There's a large picture of him on this page with the caption, Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst says, when companies plan to deliver bad or tough news, it is best not to sugarcoat things, as most employees would like to be a part of the turnaround story. And the headline on this question and answer interview, driven by passion, purpose, and smarts, Jim Whitehurst's Red Hat laurels can be traced to his Delta Air days. Jim Whitehurst, the CEO of open source software developer Red Hat, is more than the guy who brought a tech giant to downtown Raleigh. He's an entrepreneur advising, cloud computing evangelist, who once aspired to be a pro football player. Whitehurst, a STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, education enthusiast, took the time to give us our own education into what makes him tick. What led you to a career in technology? I've always been interested in technology. My first job was when I was 16 and worked as a part-time computer programmer for a stockbroker in Columbus, Georgia. I had been interested in computers for a couple of years at that point. In fact, I can remember that my prized possession was a K-Pro 2 with a 64K RAM and dual floppies. However, while I loved programming and was fascinated with computers and technology, I did not want to pursue programming as a career. My experience working with a stockbroker solidified my desire to go to college, obtain a computer science degree, and get my MBA. What's the best advice you ever received? The best advice I ever received came to me while I worked at Delta Airlines. Specifically, it was the day Delta filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. I garnered so many great lessons from that difficult experience, but the one that resonates most is to be open and honest and not sugarcoat things when delivering bad or tough news. People thirst for context. They want to know the what's and why's of their company's direction, and they want to be part of making it successful. Leaders that are accessible, answer questions, admit mistakes, and say they're sorry, those are the leaders that build credibility and ultimately earn the respect and authority to lead. What advice would you have for a triangle entrepreneur? I interact with a lot of entrepreneurs. The ones that are most successful seem to be the ones who really do something they love. They're the ones that want to make a difference and are passionate about what they're doing. If you're an entrepreneur, I would encourage you to only start a company if you love it and are passionate about doing it. I would not start a company if you're just in it to get rich or for a quick way to make a buck. It's very hard to build a thriving and inspiring company if your intentions aren't pure. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? Before I discovered computers, I was really into football and wanted to be a professional football player. I envisioned myself being a wide receiver for the Atlanta Falcons. Sorry, Carolina Panther fans, I grew up in Georgia. Once I looked past my football aspirations, I remember the movie War Games leaving a real impression on me and reaffirming my interest in technology. If you weren't the CEO of Red Hat, what job would you like to have? I would probably be a professor. I really enjoy history and economics and could see myself tucked away in a university, buried in research, writing, teaching classes, and debating with students. Who knows, maybe later in life. Where's your favorite vacation spot? My favorite spot is probably Lake Michigan. While I love traveling, I really enjoy getting to spend time with family. We have family in that area, so it's nice to go to Michigan during the summer and spend quality time with them. Plus, it's always nice to get away and recharge. What's your most memorable moment in business? I would say when I was working at the Boston Consulting Group and was called by Delta Airlines on noon of 9/11 and asked to join as acting treasurer. That was a defining moment as it not only was a defining time for Delta and in the airline industry, but it also ultimately set the course that led me to Red Hat. What was the biggest roadblock in your professional career and how did you overcome it? I'm not sure if it's a roadblock, but deciding to leave Delta Airlines was a difficult decision for me. It was 2007, after the bankruptcy turnaround. A new CEO had come in, and it felt like the right time to move on and find my next opportunity. I received dozens of calls from recruiters, but most offered opportunities to tackle other turnarounds. Turnarounds entail many hard decisions and can be stressful as well as painful. I was hoping to find something different, somewhere I could make a positive impact. Lucky for me, I received a call from a recruiter regarding Red Hat. And the rest, they say, is history. What's something that might surprise us about Jim Whitehurst? I've been told that my intense focus on health and wellness and on maximizing productivity is somewhat surprising. And along with this article, we have a box with more information titled Closer Look. Name, Jim Whitehurst. Title, President and CEO of Red Hat. Age, 46. Education, BA in Economics and Computer Science, Rice University, 1989. MBA, Harvard, 1994. Also attended Frederick Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany. And holds a general course degree from the London School of Economics. Residence, Durham. Family, wife Lauren, twins Emma and Jack. First job, when I was 16 and was a part-time computer programmer for a stockbroker in Columbus, Georgia. And in the People on the Move section, the spotlight is on Krista Evans, CEO of Hope Valley Country Club. Krista Evans grew up in the Marietta, Georgia area in a subdivision called the Atlanta Country Club. She and her siblings grew up playing soccer. riding bikes and fishing golf balls out of Soap Creek and reselling them back to the golf shop. Evans eventually parlayed that budding golf ball business into a career. And come April 15, she'll find herself the head honcho at Durham's Hope Valley Country Club, one of the Triangle's top private clubs. She currently serves as the clubhouse manager at Carolina Country Club in Raleigh. "I'm convinced that country club life is the most amazing environment," she says. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How amazingly rewarding this career is. We get to spend every day creating and strengthening relationships that have a profound impact on people's lives. What are your goals for this position? Build on the amazing foundation of members and amenities that everyone knows as the place to be. Biggest pet peeve? When one is not shown the kindness or respect that they deserve. Biggest worry? A campus like Hope Valley Country Club has lots of amenities, so my greatest concern is the safety and wellness of everyone. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook. The headline, Lessons to be Learned from Recent Jobs Report. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of Triangle Business Journal. Just a couple of days ago, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released its report on the landscape of the American workforce. A review of some of these numbers offers additional color on the post-recession employment trends, which should worry almost everyone reading this column. Top line, the U.S. is creating low-paying jobs at a much faster rate than high-paying jobs, and the jobs are increasingly getting concentrated in the 10 largest occupations. Annual mean wages were between $20,000 and $24,000 per year. Some highlights from the report. Retail salespeople and cashiers had the largest employment last year, May 2013 numbers. The two occupations, with 7.8 million workers, accounted for almost 6% of the U.S. workforce. The 10 largest occupations in the country made up 21% of the total workforce. Food preparation and serving, general office clerks, fast food, registered nurses, waiters and waitresses, and customer service representatives made up most of the largest occupations. The highest-paying occupational groups were management, legal, computer, architecture, and engineering workers. The private sector accounted for more than 90% of employment in more than half of the 821 detailed occupations, including most of the low-paying jobs. There are 2.27 million workers classified as top executives in this country, who earn about $121,000 each, mean. Of those, 248,760 are classified as CEOs, earning $178,000 apiece, mean, not average number. Interestingly, orthodontists make more than CEOs, $196,270, but there are only 5,500 of them. Also FYI, oral surgeons make much more, $218,960. There are 202,530 public relations specialists earning about $30 an hour. There are 43,360 reporters and correspondents in this country earning $21.33 an hour. And finally, for all the would-be dads and moms who want their kids to be pro athletes, the median pay for athletes, coaches, umpires, and related workers is $39,050, about $110,000 lower than a petroleum engineer, or $65,000 lower than a software developer. We have heard people making the point over and over again, education is the key to success. So, if we know the solution, why are we struggling with these macro employment trends? And also on the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read the guest column, the headline, Research Supports Medicaid Expansion. And this is written by Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow in UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. In October, I wrote about North Carolina's decision not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, or ACA. I argued that purely from an economic standpoint, it was a foolish decision that will hurt the state. I pointed to a study that showed that states rejecting Medicaid expansion will be unable to cut reimbursements to hospitals for covering the uninsured, and that these cuts would have more than offset the increased expense of expansion. As a result, not expanding Medicaid will cost the state more than expanding it. Another study I cited estimated that North Carolina could have created 6,000 more jobs last year had it expanded Medicaid. Still another study projected that because Medicaid expansion would have removed many high-risk patients from the ACA exchanges, non-expansion will raise insurance premiums for everyone. Since then, more research has been released. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation looked at the effect of a lower federal reimbursement rate to hospitals, also for covering the uninsured. The ACA reduced that rate because hospitals would receive offsetting federal funding through an expanded Medicaid, but not if Medicaid isn't expanded. As a result, during the next 10 years, hospitals in North Carolina will lose out on $11.3 billion in increased revenues. Tax preparation firm Jackson Hewitt estimated the effect of a key tax provision of the ACA. If an employee buys insurance on the ACA exchange, it triggers a tax of about $2,000 per year that must be paid by the employer. It's essentially a penalty for not providing health insurance. More low-income workers not covered by Medicaid means more workers buying their own insurance. Jackson Hewitt estimates that in North Carolina, the additional tax penalties will add up to between $80 million and $100 million next year. Economists affiliated with the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank analyzed the Massachusetts health care reforms that served as the model for the ACA and found that they led to lower rates of personal bankruptcy and delinquency and higher credit scores. But when other economists commented on this research, the consensus was that we shouldn't expect the same nice results from the ACA. Why not? Because so many states have rejected Medicaid expansion, which is a key element in how the ACA alleviates financial stress among households. The Commonwealth Fund studied the effect of Medicaid non-expansion on taxpayers. Medicaid is funded by all taxpayers, including those in North Carolina. So we're paying for it, but not reaping any of the benefits. The study estimates that by 2022, the cost of non-expansion to North Carolina's taxpayers will rise to $2.6 billion. There are new anti-expansion arguments as well. Among them is that North Carolina's Medicaid system is too expensive and that should be fixed before we expand the program. It's true that North Carolina spends more per enrollee than many of our neighbors, but we're in the middle of the pack nationwide and only slightly above the national average. It's hardly a crisis. An even weaker argument is that we should expand a program that will just drive up the federal deficit. But according to the Congressional Budget Office, the ACA as a whole, including Medicaid expansion, will slightly reduce the deficit during the next 10 years. Precisely because it includes various taxes and fees. Expanding Medicaid might mean bigger government, but not a bigger deficit. So there are strong economic arguments in favor of Medicaid expansion and weak ones against it. It's time for North Carolina to reverse itself and expand Medicaid. And with the minutes we have left, we'll read as much of this next article as we can in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Picture the IRS Naked When You File Your Tax Return. Agency rules surrounding Americans living abroad requires close scrutiny. It's that time of year you've been dreading, tax time. How can we make your tax filing experience a more bearable experience? Let's follow one common piece of advice that helps make people less nervous about public speaking. Picture the audience naked. I've never used that trick. I guess whether that would make me more comfortable or less comfortable probably depends on who is in the audience. But it struck me as a great way to add some comedic relief to your tax filing experience. Of course, it's never difficult to get a laugh at our government's expense. Where do they come up with their plans? I was at a biotechnology conference a month ago. Two statements by speakers really broke me up. One speaker summed up his tenure while he was the head of a major government agency as follows. Every day driving to work, I was always sure that one of my 80,000 employees would do something ridiculously stupid using in my name and head of the agency. Another speaker, commissioner of the U.S. and Food and Drug Administration, got a big laugh from the audience when she took a bold stand against rigid one-size-fits-all policies. The FDA commissioner didn't convince the room full of drug development people, for whom the FDA bureaucracy is a major industry hurdle, that the FDA was now a flexible, user-friendly agency. But she did earn votes as a possible successor to Jimmy Fallon if he flops as the Tonight Show host. As a securities lawyer, I always get a big kick out of the Securities and Exchange Commission. A decade ago, the SEC issued rules that require all securities disclosure documents to be written in plain English. That might not be funny if you haven't read any SEC rules, but it's hysterical to securities lawyers like me who wonder, what was the native language of our rules makers? DOS gets the most votes. I'm convinced the whole government is a robot that someone mistakenly believes can learn English. Our government's long-term struggles with communications raise the question, is this a global problem? Do Chinese bureaucrats require people to speak in plain Chinese when they file documents with their government? I wonder what plain Chinese looks like. Of course, the Internal Revenue Service usually represents America in the World Bureaucrat Olympics, where bureaucrats around the world compete by creating the most confusing forms. That's one Olympics where America brings home lots of gold. What bureaucrat Olympic event does America usually win? Just like America fields a dream team in Olympic basketball, America always wins the persistence prize. Most countries stop taxing their citizens when they move abroad to live or work. That's where American bureaucrats run up the score on their foreign counterparts. They make America's 80-point victory over Nigeria in the 2012 Olympics look like a close game. And we'll have to stop there with attorney Jim Verdonik's article. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.